Welcome, everyone, to the newest episode on the Baseball Prospectus Podcast Network. It's a continuation of our Top Prospect Podcast series. I'm your host, Smith Brickner, and joining me to do the Texas Rangers is my colleague and good friend, Grant Schiller. And Grant, we've had a lot of conversations on baseball over the years. Uh-huh. I think this might be the first time that we're talking about real baseball instead of virtual video game baseball.
Yeah, we've talked plenty. We've even done podcasts together, but never real baseball. Either the long, distinct RFB or the still running strong OOTP.
Yes. Yeah. I forgot about that. Wow. The first one that you mentioned there. But in any event, so, you know, you are a Texas man, so It would make sense that you are the guy that covers the Texas Rangers. You've done a lot of really good work covering guys on the Monday morning 10 packs, and no surprise that you're the lead guy for the Rangers here. But before we get into the farm system itself, let's talk briefly about the Major League team.
Yeah.
They started to spend money last offseason, which is always a good thing. They have indicated and begun to show that they are willing to spend money again this offseason. And I think people that were expecting them to take a quantum leap last year might have been overstating it. But I think this year, if you have the right combination of offseason transactions and internal player development, you're looking at a team that could absolutely compete for a wild card spot.
Yeah, no, I mean, 100%. That was always the plan. I mean, at the end of last year, I know you had fans talking about, oh, they spent $500 million in one, 70 games, something like that. But it was never about last year. They jumped the market a year early to compete in 2023 and 2024. And I mean, as we'll see, a lot of these prospects in the top 10 today are 2024 ETAs. That's really the next wave. But they have a good lineup in place already, frankly, with Seager, Semien, a few of the others.
Lau really stepped up last year.
He had a big year. Adolis repeated a good year, which I was not expecting at all.
Jonah Heim really coming out of the woodworks there.
Yep. And then Young debuted, Ezekiel Duran debuted last year and should be ready to hit the ground running this next year. Leody Taveras took a step up. And the lineup's there. They just have to go buy almost an entirely new pitching staff. But if they do that, they can compete for a wild card this year. And I mean, the plan has always been to compete for a wild card in 23 and then try and do more in 24.
And before we get into the farm, I think it's important to mention that we have had turnover in the front office. There is new upper management. Chris Young, the former, I think he's what, 6'10"? So 6'10", he's probably
6'11".
The tallest general manager on record, right? I think so. Ivy League, you know, guy, so perfect for that brand, if you will. But, you know, he's made some, I think, some very smart moves, really, since he's taken place as the head of the baseball operations department over there. But that will feed into our farm system discussion, because I think the farm itself, as you alluded to, is focused in the short term. A lot of the prospects are relatively close to the big leagues. And I think the overall talent of the farm system has taken a major step forward over the past couple of years.
No, absolutely. And this is something that probably would have happened a while ago. John Daniels, who now is a special advisor with, I believe, the Rays.
Yes.
Is somebody who, at his best as a GM, has been building a farm system. Built the 2010, 2011, 2012 Rangers. Rebuilt the farm system during that time, along with AJ Preller, it should be mentioned, to really be able to trade a lot of talent and bolster the team for 2015 and 16. And then with the new stadium coming in 2020, ownership would not let him to tear down when he was wanting to. So this rebuild was delayed in order to chase, I don't know, maybe an 85-win team in 2020, which obviously did not happen for numerous reasons, one being COVID and two being the team just being very bad. But ownership really held back this rebuild until after that 2020 season. And since then, these last 2 years, this farm has taken huge steps forward. There's still holes in it, but it is maybe the deepest farm system in the league at this point.
Deepest, I think there's a consideration. Is there a open question, though, about a lack of true impact talent at the top? Because it's funny, because I think that they are the – I think there's a huge difference in some of the other farm systems that we've talked about, and most namely the Mets and Rockies come to mind, where it's just really top-heavy. But you, and even the Phillies, I mean, super top-heavy, but you're struggling to find guys after 15 – that you feel could make a major league impact at some point. This is not the case. This is easily one of the deepest lists that I think we've gone through, because just going through this list before we were doing the podcast, I mean, there's guys all the way down to like 18 or 19 that I feel pretty confident will have a major league impact at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think this is probably one of the only lists where who was at 19 and 20 was a legitimate debate.
Yeah,
and there were a lot of guys. I mean, not even in the top 20, you've got Zach Kent, Cole Reagans, Cody Bradford, are three guys who might start major league games next year. In almost any other system, they're at least top 20 guys. Now, like you said, there's a lack of impact prospects, and we'll get into kind of some of the reasons why. But just in terms of depth, it is how quickly they've generated that depth is a testament to the IFA scouts.
Yeah,
They've gotten a lot of talent in from Latin America the last few years. And then they totally did a 180 flip on their draft philosophy. And it has added in a lot of, if not crazy high upside bats like they used to go for, a lot of just solid bats who project for utility roles or as second division starters somewhere in that territory.
And that really feeds us into our first prospect in the top 10. Evan Carter, an outfielder drafted, I believe, in the second round of the 2020 yes. draft. Yes. Signed for seven figures, just north of $1 million. I remember the discourse when Carter was drafted. It was kind of a who moment. And boy, the Rangers look really smart for this, because you're talking about a guy that across high-end AA hit 295, 397, and walked almost as much as he struck out. And on top of that, the power, which was always the question, it seemed like it started to come around towards the end of last season. And, you know, we don't like to get into the idea of if this guy fills out, he could add more power, but I really do think that's the case here with Carter.
Yeah, I agree. It going back to when he was drafted, like you were talking about, it was a who. He was not on any list. But then after the draft, they take him second. Everybody's going, what are they doing? They come out in the post-draft and they're kind of, I don't know if arrogance is the right word, but they sound a little bit arrogant. Like, we out-scouted everybody and found this guy. And mm-hmm. the track record of drafting up to that point was, this is one of the worst drafting teams in the league. Yeah. So I don't know who they think they are. They out-scouted people. Turns out they out-scouted people. He's just very good. You've got the kind of natural tools. He's got a quick bat, a good swing without many holes in it. He's a fast guy. He hits the ball hard, even if the power hasn't always come around. But you add to that the more advanced aspects that this organization is putting a lot more emphasis on. He picks up spin really well. Really good feel for the zone. Really strong approach in which he's very patient and won't expand. But if he gets his pitch early, he's going to jump on it and pound it. He's a little bit raw in center field, but I think eventually with the athleticism, he's going to be fine out there. The routes will get better. It's not like they're terrible now.
He won a minor league Gold Glove award, right?
I don't know. I'm not sure, honestly. I can tell you from his little time at Frisco, he's a little bit slow on the uptake on routes, but he closes ground really quickly, and he's still just 20. So I imagine at the end of the day, he's going to be above average out there. And like you said, he already hit 43 extra base hits last year with 12 home runs and notably 10 triples. But he's so skinny right now. He's the smallest 6'4 kid I've ever seen. And as he adds to his body, if he grows into more power, he's the guy where there is impact star potential. Even if he doesn't, he's going to be a high OBP, good hit tool with some power center fielder that racks up value quickly. But if he does grow into power as he's able to hit the weight room, that's when you really get into this guy could be really, really, really strong.
So to my previous point, he actually was a Gold Glover. I don't think they separated left field, right field, center field in the minor leagues when they did this, but he was one of three alongside two other very high profile prospects, Jackson Chourio, Pete Crow Armstrong. So, I mean, I really do think it is just a matter of power for Evan Carter. And if he's able to add 10 healthy muscular pounds, watch out. I mean, you're talking about a guy that, to your point, could be a high end, very, very high end player in the major leagues. That does bring us to number two. It is a guy that's already in the major leagues, Josh Jung. And, you know, it might be a little bit surprising to people to see us grade Evan Carter ahead of Jung. And look, I don't think it's that we're opposed to Josh Jung as a prospect, but I really do think it speaks more to how you and I and the rest of the team feel about Evan Carter as a prospect.
Yeah, I agree with that. Carter just doesn't have many holes. Right. If the question of you as a prospect is, do you hit 15 home runs or do you hit 25 home runs? And that's really the big sticking point. You're probably a pretty good prospect and you're going to be pretty good either way. With Jung, it starts to get a little bit into the territory of, he's a very good hitter and a very good player, but it starts to get into the territory of why the system has depth but doesn't have a ton of impact prospects. He is one of there's a multitude of guys in the system who are either good hitters who need to overcome a lack of glove value, and there's lots of good gloves who are having to find an amount of value there that they're not going to find with the bat. There's not a ton that have both, which Carter has, which is why there's a lot of good prospects, but no great ones.
Right.
Jung is the best bat of that group. The glove is fine. Nobody's going to grade it as a 3 or a 4. It's a 45 or a 50 at third base. It's not going to play him off of it, but he's not going to provide much value there. Same on the bases. So it really all comes down to the bat. He's a good hitter. He's another guy who, prior to this season, when he started late with an injury, which has been an issue for him throughout his career, he previously had picked up breaking balls fairly well, and he had walked more than he did this season. But the main thing is he just hit the ball extremely hard, and he's able to do it to all fields. So it's a decent enough hit tool. He picks up spin at a big league level until this season where he got a late start, which you kind of write it off for that, at least to some extent. And he can hit over the fence. So when you project him out, there's likely going to be a couple seasons in here where he's going to go 270 with 30 home runs. There's also going to be seasons where he does less. Now, we'll say his big league debut did not go necessarily according to plan, but it's just so hard to tell whether that's, you know, he started in August and was rushed up.
Yep.
Or there was an actual regression in his approach.
Again, it's a small sample size alert, so be on the alert for this. But he did make contact in the zone at roughly a league average clip, slightly below, but very doable for a guy that has that kind of impact when he hits the ball. Did chase about 6% more than the league average, and also made 6% less contact out of the zone than the league average. So, you know, the concern, to your point, is he going to be able to pick up breaking pitches that break out of the strike zone but start in the strike zone? That's going to be the real question for Jung. But, you know, I think he's going to probably play third base for the team, but if the team holds on to Ezekiel Duran and they want to place a premium on defense, maybe there's a scenario where Jung is playing first base, you move Nathaniel Lowe, to DH, and then you've got an infield of Ezekiel Duran, Kyle Seager, Marcus Semien, and Josh Jung. I mean, I think you could do a lot worse than that group.
Yes,
over there,
you could. So, and it makes sense to me if that's the way they do want to go once maybe Garver leaves in free agency, who's probably going to be their DH this year, because Lowe he's a mannequin at first base. And yeah, Duran has lots of potential to be a well above average defensive third baseman.
Yeah.
With more work there. So I think if they were to hold on to everybody, that's probably the ideal defensive alignment. Just won't be for 2023.
You know, if Mitch Garver's the reason you're not going to put the ideal defensive infield there, like, I just can't. Like, if I was running a team, I would never let that be the reason I don't put that infield out there. But that's just me. I mean, that's personally me. But I understand what you're saying. You know, they want to see if Garver with a healthy season can put it all together. Again, if he can put it together with a healthy season, big question mark there. But number three, Jack Leiter, probably the highest profile prospect in the farm system. So it might be considered a letdown. He's number three. And listen, again, similar to Young being ranked second overall in this farm, I don't think it's a slight to Leiter. Yes, there are some red flags in this profile. But again, I think it is just a testament to Young and to Carter ahead of him. Now, having said that, he did have more than a 5.5 ERA, a 5 FIP. He really struggled to command the ball, any pitch, basically glove side. Where do we stand with Leiter? Because the upside's there, the stuff is still there, but the command we expect to be a little bit better than it has been. So where do we stand with Leiter?
Yeah, it's, I guess the way I look at it, I'm not at a point of concern yet, but I am paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
If he comes back in spring training next year and has the same problems, that's when it's going to be a point of concern. I think it's important to preface this discussion, I guess, with both Young and Leiter, because we're going to talk plenty about their faults and their red flags. But they're both probably top 50 guys. So they're still very strong prospects.
Yeah.
But with Leiter, it was just a rough season. A lot of reasons for it, but it was rough. Some of that is just them pushing him straight to double A out of college, which Vanderbilt or not, SEC or not, that's a massive jump. And then some of that is mechanical issues. Some of it is his stuff did back up throughout the year. The jump on and ride on his fastball were not the same in April as they were in March, and they weren't the same in August as they were in April. He couldn't land his curveball for strikes all season long.
Yeah.
He was missing glove side consistently with everything all season long.
Yep.
And once that started to get away from him, he couldn't fix it mid-inning. He'd go five scoreless, and the one other inning would be a six-run inning. That was a very common thing with him this year. So he's got to find more zone. He's got to land his curveball for strikes because hitters were just able to sit back on the fastball. They knew nothing else was going to be in the zone. And he has enough stuff. He's got three pitches which flash double plus in the fastball, slider, and curveball. He's got enough. He doesn't have to have perfect command, but he has to land them all for strikes. And he has to get back to throwing his best stuff more consistently.
And he also introduced a cutter, which you could have mentioned this in your write-up there, but the Rangers feel confident that that could be a really good pitch based off his release point. So that's another dimension to consider here. Like, even if the slider, he can't command it for strikes, if you're able to at least command the cutter for strikes, it still works well off of the curveball, I think, just from his arm slot. So that could be an additional margin for error for him. Now, with these struggles that he had this year, especially commanding the ball, because I think that's the biggest thing here. I would say the odds of him being a high-end starter were probably 50-50 last year. And if not a high-end starter, he'd be, you know, a mid-rotation starter. Where do you stand on that probability at this point of him becoming a number two or even number one starter?
Yeah, I think it's still in there, definitely. Anytime you have a fastball you can get misses in the zone with and two off-speed pitches, which are not just plus, but at their best double plus, and the cutter coming, it's still in there. But if you're asking me what's most likely, is his control command is going to hold him back to being a mid-rotation guy. More of a number three who might have a pop-up year here and there in which he shows more of the potential, but isn't consistently at that level.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the Rangers probably, if you're getting them to be honest with you, I think they would have expected a little bit more from Leiter, given that he dominated in the SEC And it wasn't even just that, but it was he didn't have these command issues. So, you know, truly, I think the key to unlocking Leiter will be if he can just get the command specifically to the glove side with his breaking pitches, at least to a 45, because right now I think it's teetering on the 3-4 right now based off what he did last year. So that's going to be essential for him. And that does bring us to our second pitcher on the top 10, Owen Waite, ranked at number 4. I remember he was one of those guys in that D-load program along with Mason Engler, and I'm forgetting the other pitcher right now.
Cole Wynn,
yeah. Yeah.
Destin Dotson.
Yes.
They had a lot of them, and Cole Reagans was on that.
Yes. Yes.
It was a big group, but it did not go well.
A massive group of power arms that sure enough had forearm fatigue or Tommy John surgery. And Owen Waite actually had both of those. He had Tommy John surgery within a year of that D-load program. He also had forearm fatigue in 2022, and we're talking about a guy that has electric stuff when healthy. But again, as is the case with a lot of these power arms, it's not a matter of, you know, when he if he's going to produce, but if he's going to be healthy enough to produce.
Right. Yeah. And honestly, if there weren't so many health questions with White, I think he'd have a really strong case to be above Leiter as the top.
I'm with you there.
Throwing arm on this in this system. And the thing with him, he's got good stuff. It's not as good as Leiter's, but it certainly works, and he does have strong control command. I'm going to put you on the spot real quick, though, with stuff. Solely in terms of stuff, throw out control command, mechanics, repeatability, health, all that. What are the most important items you look for, solely in terms of stuff?
I mean, do you get swings and misses in the zone? I think it's probably the most important thing. And when guys do make contact, are they squaring it up?
Yeah, okay. I'm for the most part on the same page with you. I'd say specifically fastballs in the zone, if you can get swings and misses with, is huge. And if you can get chases with your breaking stuff. And those are two things he does very, very well. Fastball is mid-90s, but it's got big life. Gets a lot of misses in the zone. The slider is his best off-speed. Breaks two plane very late, and he gets a lot of chases down out of the zone and out on his glove side with that. And he's able to use the curve and changeup as well. Not to the same extent as the slider, but they're both at least big league average offerings and project as a little bit more. So you have 4 legitimate pitches, and he is able to dot up on corners. He throws lots of strikes. He's a very fiery competitor. So there's good makeup there.
Are you saying he's got that dog in him, Grant?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying, yes. he actually, coming off the forearm fatigue, he came back for the Texas League Championship Series as a reliever. And in his one inning in that series was, or one outing, after each inning, he was yelling at the other team. And that is very much in his profile as a person.
I love it.
I believe it's Tepid Participation, who is big in Rangers minor league circles, nicknamed him Bar Fight White, as somebody who would want by his side in a bar fight.
I love that. Bar Fight White. Oh, we are so in on Owen Waite now because of that. So I love it. I absolutely love it. That brings us to number 5, Luis Angel Acuña. He is tabbed Little Acuña. Yes, he is related to that Acuña on the Braves. But, you know, it's a very different profile. So I don't think comparing him to his cousin, his big brother, is going to do him any service, because he's, you know, a smaller guy. He's 5'10", doesn't have the bat speed that Ronald has. He's got, you know, obviously a smaller stature. So, you know, while we're not comparing him in any stretch of the imagination to big brother Ronald, you're still talking about a guy that can have above average offensive seasons as an infielder. And, you know, listen, that's going to have value in the major leagues.
Yeah, exactly. I think that sums him up very well, actually. The swing is actually very similar to Ronald, but offensively he hits the ball very hard. He's willing to take his walks. He's a little aggressive, which is a good thing in some scenarios. He'll jump on some pitches early in counts, but he's also going to swing and miss big. He has a good B swing, so it doesn't drive up his strikeouts too far. But he's going to have some above average offensive seasons. And when you pair that with double plus speed and good base running instincts, and with an above average glove at short or plus at second, probably, that builds up value really, really quickly.
Yes.
It's not the flashiest player, but if you start looking at big league comps for that, you're looking at what? Maybe a better version of Dansby Swanson before this last season.
Yeah.
Worse glove, but better bat and base runner. And that pulls up what? Anywhere from 2 to 4 wins pretty quickly at those positions.
I really do like that comp. I mean, obviously not Dansby Swanson from this most recent season, but I mean, if you're talking about Dansby Swanson from last year, right, or even 2020, right, anywhere from 100 to 110, you know, 5 to 10% better than league average offensively with plus defensive work at shortstop, that's easily going to put up at least 3 to 4 WAR every year. And you add on the base stealing numbers, and yeah, I mean, you're talking about a guy that could, if it all comes together like we think it could, you know, he could be making a couple of all-star games when all said and done. And listen, the fact that we're still talking about guys that have that kind of upside up until number 5 is really promising. Now, having said that, you know, if there was a downside, the kryptonite to Acuña's game, what do you think that is at the moment?
There's probably a couple. I think there's some risk just in his approach that the walks and strikeouts grow further apart than they've been so far. And if that happens, then the slightly above average offensive profile comes down a notch.
Yeah.
The other is probably that the arm is not truly plus for shortstop. So the hands and glove and athleticism are all really good over there. But the arm is going to hold him back from being really one of the best defenders in the game at that position.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And listen, we always talk about guys that play premium positions as having a floor because, you know, it's not like first base or left field where if it doesn't work out there, your options are very limited, you know, because you're on the end of the defensive spectrum. With Acuña, at worst, it kind of feels like a guy that can be a utility guy.
Exactly.
And,
yeah.
You know, to have that kind of floor at number 5 with the above average offensive and defensive profile as the ceiling at number 5, I really can't remember a time where the Rangers had that deep of a prospect base where that was your 5th best prospect. In previous years, that might be their 2nd or 3rd best prospect.
Yeah, it would. And then back in the Preller days, your 5th best prospect would be a 101 guy.
Yeah.
It would be somebody who's either going to be 10 WAR or negative 5.
Right, right. Literally bit, Nomar Mazara.
Right, right. Yeah. A little bit bigger variance back then.
Yes, yes, yes. All right, so number 6. This is really interesting. Brock Porter was the guy that the Rangers got in the 3rd round of this most recent draft, but he signed for more than $3.5 million. So he was paid like a mid-first rounder, honestly. And they used the underslot deal for a pitcher we will talk about later to make this happen with Porter. And we now have Porter ahead of said pitcher. So when you were doing your work on Porter, what really stood out to you and convinced you that he should be ahead of said pitcher who I'll mention later?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Just a few months after a draft to have a 4th rounder ahead of the number 3 overall pick.
And listen, I think that's a little misleading, right?
Yeah,
I think
pure it is.
You know, the signing bonus, I think, would speak more to the overall talent profile. But even so, yeah, I would agree.
Yeah. But you look at Porter, he's a righty high school prep arm. So he's going to be a high-risk guy. That's just how it works. And he's a northern righty high school prep arm. So that adds even more variance up and down. But when you can touch 100 and you've got a double plus change, you're working with some pretty good building blocks. And he was projected as a mid first rounder. He was paid as a mid first rounder. So that's really more about where his value is. And there's just a lot of upside here. He's a big kid. He's got more good weight to put on his lower half. He's already mid to upper nines with the fastball, and it does have run and life already. And what he calls a helicopter changeup just comes out of the hand as a fastball and dies floating to the plate.
Yeah.
Doing video scouting work on him because he hasn't thrown a professional pitch yet. Watching high school kids try to hit that pitch was pretty interesting.
Yeah, I don't think Michigan high schoolers are used to a Brock Porter level talent. No. That way.
No.
So the biggest thing for him moving forward will be that development of a consistent breaking pitch, right? And there is feel for spin, but as you would expect with a cold weather prep arm, it's wildly inconsistent at this point. So it will be important for him to develop that as much as it will be to grow into his lower half of his body. So, you know, we've got the OFP 55 on him. And again, at number six, that's probably not the case in previous years. So a testament to just how quickly the Rangers have revamped their farm system here. Number seven is Aaron Zavala, drafted 30th overall in the 2021 draft at the University of Oregon. A little bit of an underslot guy, signed for $830,000. But, you know, again, similar to Carter, you're talking about a guy that's got an elite eye, makes really good swing decisions. But, you know, there are some reasons why we have him considerably lower than Carter. So why don't you delve into those reasons?
Right. So the difference here, Carter has more power upside. He's got a little bit better of a hit tool. And more importantly, Carter's a great base runner who can play center field. Zavala is a corner outfielder. He's probably going to be limited to being a platoon bat, although he'll be a very good one, I would expect. But a corner outfield platoon bat only has so much potential for value.
Yeah.
Unless you're hitting the ball like Barry Bonds against righties, you're going to be a little bit capped in your value.
I'm going to say it's safe to say he's not going to be Barry Bonds against righties.
I would say that's a fair assessment. But at the same time, he provides a pretty strong floor despite those factors because his swing decisions are so great.
Yeah.
And with a guy whose profile is so built around the swing decisions, what really kills a lot of those profiles is they're not able to punish and hit hard pitches thrown in the zone. If pitchers can attack you with three fastballs in the zone and get you out, you're not going to get walked because they're just going to go right at you. Mm-hmm. He's able to do that. He hits the ball hard. He doesn't lift it so much currently. He's more of a straight line drive guy, but he does have plus pop in there when he wants to access it.
He did have 16 home runs this year, which is not nothing.
Right. And he slugged .491 against righties. Also not nothing.
Right. That'll apply.
Yeah. So you look at a guy who, I wouldn't say this is the likely outcome, but there's a realistic chance, at least against right-handed pitchers, he's a 400 OBP, 450 slug guy. And that's going to get you lots of value. He just doesn't expand the zone, and he'll hit it hard if you come to him. He's just a good hitter. He doesn't provide value elsewhere, but he's a good hitter.
So what do you? I know that you're saying that he's probably a strong side platoon bat. What are the chances, though, that he does become an everyday player with his ability to hit lefties?
It's in there. He has not shown much ability to hit lefties, but when you refuse to expand the zone to the extent that he does, it does provide you at least something of an offensive floor in terms of a guaranteed OBP or walk rate, right? So that provides a little bit of an offensive floor. He just doesn't punish lefties much. I'd be surprised if he became an everyday outfielder. But look, if he hit his 70th, 80th percentile outcome, that's probably there.
Yeah, I think it is. But we like to rank prospects based on where we think their 55th to 60th percentile outcome looks. So, you know, for Zavala, he's the first of the OFP 50. So just kind of break it down for everyone. The OFP sixes really end at number four. So one through four are your sixes. Everyone from five to, well, actually just two of them, five to six, Brock Porter are 55s. And then starting with Zaval at 7, you begin to have the OP5. So you've got three tiers amongst the top 10, Zaval being the top of those OP5s. Right behind him, though, is another outfielder, Anthony Gutierrez. And he was one of their most recent IFA signees, signed for just under $2 million in January of this year. Grant, I think the best way to describe it is he is a 17-year-old and we have no idea what to expect.
Yeah, pretty much. I don't know if this is going to make it the print or not, but what I put for the OFP is he's a 50, and I put heck if I know he's 17. But he's a big 17-year-old who is supposed to be able to play center field. He hits the ball hard. He's a good runner, strong arm. You hear the kind of things from him about him from those out in surprise who got to see him this year that you did about some of the other really young Latin guys that they brought up that have done well. Leody Taveras is the last guy I remember hearing such positive reviews about out of Rangers camp for a young Latin American kid like this. So they don't tend to hype everyone up to this extent. So you put a little bit more value in that. Mm-hmm. And we don't know what the swing decisions are like at this point. He's barely played stateside. We don't know everything about him, but we do know they really like him, and there's a potential for 5 real tools here.
Yeah, I mean, there's always the potential for 5 tools until you pretty much show that you don't have 5 tools. But you mentioned it in the report. He's 6'3". He's a big kid. He's got a lot of athleticism, and obviously he's got that frame to grow into more.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the variance here is extreme, probably the highest variance of any prospect in the top 10 on this list. But not far behind him is the guy that's right behind him on this list. That was a good transition to Kumar Rocker. He was drafted 3rd overall in the 2022 draft by the Rangers and actually signed with them, unlike he did the previous year with the New York Mets. But Grant, this is going to be the big conversation piece. I guarantee you're going to be given a lot of questions about this when this list goes live. So why don't you save yourself some time and kind of explain why Rocker is much lower than even some guys drafted in the same draft as him.
Right. There's just so many different ways to look at Rocker. But with that, there's just so much risk with Rocker. He was drafted number 3 for a reason, right? He was drafted number 8 last year for a reason. He was 10th last year. He was a first-round pick out of high school, projected, for a reason. Like, he's got a power-sinking fastball. He's got a nasty, nasty slider. And throughout his college, independent days, he's thrown strikes. So if you just take those three things, you would think this is a top-notch pitching prospect. But there are a lot of buts. The mechanics right now are just a mess. I don't know if you were able to see much of him out of the AFL, but he has changed it quite a bit, and it is...
It was alarmingly different from Vanderbilt. And honestly, like, it's funny because he was with Tri-City, the indie ball team, to begin the year, and it looked like there were some pretty drastic changes even from then as well.
Yes.
Because I remember Jeffrey looking and scouting him multiple times and thinking that, oh, he's definitely going to be a first rounder. It's just a matter of where. But I think if you were to assess him now and redraft the 2022 draft, he's not going in the first round at this point.
Yeah, and he's certainly not going number 3. If the Rangers are going to save money to get Porter, I think they're looking elsewhere. The thing about it is he changed mechanics, at least theoretically from what we know, to try and protect his shoulder. But if you look at his current mechanics, so much of it is putting so much added pressure onto both his elbow and his shoulder. And for somebody who didn't sign with the Mets for medical reasons and then had surgery on the shoulder, that really, really scares me.
Mm-hmm. It's not great. But listen, we do have a track record of dominance in the SEC. We have a track record of not incredible mechanics, but passable given the stuff. And listen, the Rangers are, they have a new player development group, right? They have a new front office that you don't know the kind of effect that they're going to have on pitchers moving forward, on hitters moving forward. So we're not giving up hope on Kumar Rocker. If we were giving up hope, he'd be more like 15th on this list, given his current positioning. But again, you're just, we, as I've said on almost all the other top prospect podcasts, we like to lean into the volatility. If we think that there's a guy with more upside in the same OFP tier as other guys, even if there's extreme risk, we're going to lean into that volatility. Because listen, if he's even 90% of what he was coming out of the draft last year when he's drafted by the Mets, it's going to be a really, really good prospect. And listen, it's not likely, but there's still a chance that Rocker is a top three prospect in this farm system next year if some of those kinks in the delivery do get figured out and revert back to what they were, at least to some extent, in 2021.
Yeah, 100%. Like, if everything clicks here, he could still be a front-of-the-line power arm. If half the things click here, he could still be a really good bullpen arm.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a lot of things that have to click.
Yeah,
and it's I guess two ways of looking at it. It's pretty great for the farm system if your number three overall pick is only number nine. That says some good things about everything else, but it says pretty poor things for that selection if just a few months after the pick, your number three overall pick is number nine.
Yeah,
he could change that, but as of right now, it's an issue.
What would you say the odds are that he fixes at least most of the issues there and is in the top three or four prospect conversation for the team next year?
Gosh, I don't know if I could even tell you without looking at a medical, but if we throw away the injury risk, just because we're not able to fully evaluate it, top three or four, it'd probably be somewhere 50-50 if he was to stay healthy.
Okay.
But
that's actually higher than I was expecting. Okay.
Yeah, but that's taking away a big part of why he's down number nine, is the health risk.
Yeah, that's a fair point. That's a fair point. But, you know, listen, there's absolutely a possibility that Rocker is in the OFP 55, OFP 6 group next year. But there's also a chance that we're talking about soft OFP 50 or even 45 next year if things continue down the way that they have been going in recent months. So, you know, outside of Gutierrez being extreme variance just because of his youth, Rocker extreme variance because of just the lack of consistent health. But moving on to number 10 is Dustin Harris, another outfielder in this top 10. Man, they just have a ton of outfielders in this top 10. But, you know, he was drafted in the 11th round of the 2019 draft out of a junior college, signed for $250,000. And this is another guy that, I mean, listen, anytime you're drafting someone in the 11th round that become a top 10 prospect for you in a very deep farm system, that is a great accomplishment. But Harris, I feel like, is the least known of all the other outfielders that has been in the minor leagues for a couple of years, at least in this farm system. So why don't you give everyone your take on where Harris stands at the moment?
Yeah, and I think he's probably the least known because this is where there is a bit of a drop-off to me for the first time. He's still an OFP 50, but he's at the lower end of that.
Mm-hmm.
He, calling him an outfielder might be a little bit generous at this point, but that's his position.
I just went with what you put on the sheet ahead of time.
He plays outfield. He just does not play it well, at least yet.
Well, Dominic Smith and J.D. Davis also played the outfield. So, you know,
Josh Naylor
played the outfield.
He is a better athlete than those guys, at least. Yeah, although he has not been much better.
I would
than
hope
outfielder.
So, but. Okay. All right.
But Harris is a good hitter. There's just a lot of very high highs with him and very low lows. So just from a pure athlete perspective, like, he's got plus raw. He's a really strong runner once he gets going. There's a reason that he was a 2020 guy in 2021, and if he hadn't gotten hurt in 22, he was probably going to repeat it. With that athleticism, though, the low end of that is he's not really a quick twitch guy. He's a good athlete once he gets going, but it takes him a while to get going. with the power, it's great. Plus raw power, the low is he doesn't get to his top line max exit velo very often. He can hit the ball very hard, but he doesn't do it with a ton of consistency.
And why do you think that is? Is it an aggressiveness, or is it a lack of pitch recognition? Is it a little bit of both?
No, he's got a good approach. Lack of pitch recognition plays into it a little bit. It's pretty specifically, he grooves his swing a little bit, so there's some spots where you can beat him. So he doesn't have a very adjustable swing. But the biggest thing is there's just a huge hole that pitchers were able to attack all year. If you were able to throw off speed, middle in or middle in off the plate, Harris was going to swing at it, and he was almost certainly going to swing and miss at it. And once you got him there, you're able to attack him with other stuff. You're able to attack him with fastballs up, fastballs away, and keep him from hitting the ball hard. So that hole exists both in his swing and in his vision. And if he can fix one of those two, it's a big deal. But while it's there, he's going to get to the big league level, and there's going to be a very specific way to attack him.
Yeah, and at that point, if the holes don't fix themselves, you got a guy with two holes in his swing in the zone, and a guy that probably is not going to be an outfielder, so at best he's a first base DH type. And you just have to be a massive mega producer offensively to have that limit of a defensive upside. So, yeah, I mean, to your point, you know, I think there's a clear tier 1 through 3, or even 1 through 4, really. And I guess 5 through 6 would be its own tier. 7 through 9 would be its own tier. And I suppose that with Harris being number 10, I would imagine that's the beginning of tier number 4.
Yeah.
Because you're right, I do think there is a pretty big drop-off here in the top 10 when you match up Rocker to Harris. But, you know, listen, we've seen guys fix these holes in their swing before. We're not saying it's impossible, but this is typically the most difficult thing to develop, to break out of that slug in those parts of the zone. So he's going to have to go against the odds here to fix those holes in his swing. So that's not the best sign in the world if you're trying to make him a starter. Now, having said that, whenever you have this kind of athleticism, that would be the case for someone being able to fix the holes in their swing. When you've got that kind of athleticism, and I know he's not quick twitch, but when you've got the strength, the pop that he has, right, you're always going to give yourself at least a fighting chance to fix those holes. So with that in mind, you know, I would say that the odds of him adjusting those holes in his swing probably at, what, a 30 to 35% chance at this point? Is that fair?
Yeah, that's probably fair. And the makeup plays into that a little bit too, in that so many of these guys, we could have raved about their makeup on this top 10. Like, such hard workers, such competitors, that's something they place a real premium on.
Yeah.
And Harris certainly has fine makeup. I'm not saying anything negative about it or here to tear it down. He's just not that over-the-top, get-to-the-park-early, work on a swing, take extra rounds of BP, go to the cages. That's not been him so far.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that's probably going to be very important as he tries to accomplish this.
That's really good intel because, you know, it's as much about the mental side of the game as it is physical. And I think we often get so infatuated with the physical side of the game that we oftentimes do lose sight of just how important that mental aspect of the game is. I mean, you talk to any guy that's been in the major leagues, and the biggest adjustment they always talk about is just the mental side of the game. So it's a great point. And I think it's important that you bring up that, you know, you got a lot of rave reviews about players and their makeup throughout this top 10. Certainly does not hurt their chances of being impact big leaguers. All right, so we've covered the top 10 in under 50 minutes. Quite the accomplishment, Grant. Did not think we could do it, but here we are. So we can top it off here, a really good episode here with your personal cheese ball outside the top 10. Who you got for us?
Yeah, so Yason Mortabel is probably the best player outside the top 10. I bet he's a top 10 guy next year once we have some full season data on him. But I'm going to throw a more fun one at you. Number 20 down here, we've got Emiliano Teodo. He probably is not even number 20, if we're being honest, but he's who I wanted to put on here to talk about. And he's got such a higher upside than the other options, which is really what the decision came down to. He's one of those guys who he's Nick LaLoosh. Like, he throws 101, 102 at the top end with huge spin, and he's got a curveball that's in the low 90s with over 3,000 RPM. Like, if he figures out how to throw strikes, he's either going to be the best closer in the game, or if he finds out how to throw strikes and figures out how to throw a changeup, he's going to be, like, incredible. Like, I have on here, like, an August 25th line, he got 12 outs, 11 of them were strikeouts, he allowed no hits, and only threw 51% strikes. Like, it could go anywhere, but if it goes 100th percentile, he's a star.
That's incredible. Like, I'm a big sucker for these guys with the huge strikeout stuff that are in the low minors, because, listen, the command sometimes for these power throwers, you know, I think pitchers largely can be thrown into two buckets, right? It's either they've got really good command and you're hoping that the stuff advances as it goes through the minor leagues. Then you've got the other group that have the huge stuff and their whole minor league career is just about honing it in, trying to throw more strikes. I'd say there's more success with guys that have the command already and can just build the stuff.
Yep.
So that's why we have him where he's 20th on this list, right? Not top 15 or anything like that. But again, he's one of those guys where if it just clicks, if the command gets to an even, let's say 45 or 50, you're talking about a very high-end reliever here. And the Rangers, to their credit, have developed a lot of excellent relievers over the years that had some considerable command issues early on in their minor league careers.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the back of their pen right now, you've got Jonathan Hernandez and Jose Leclerc.
Yeah. They had Emmanuel Clase at one point.
Yes, that's right. Who they got for Brett Nicholas, if you'll never forget.
That's remembering a some names guy.
And then they traded him for one inning of Corey Kluber. So Clase's been traded for very little value.
Wow.
And he's extremely good.
Wow. That's got to go down as one of the more lopsided trades in recent memory, right?
Yeah, both ways. Yeah. I mean, it's Kluber, and that was part of, to circle back to what we talked about at the very start, ownership wanting to compete in 2020 despite not having the team to do it. It was trading for Corey Kluber for 2020 to try and win 83 games. I mean, that's the cost of having ownership that wants to sell seats in a new stadium rather than really compete.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, listen, you know, the Rangers, they have a new farm, that they have a new president of baseball operations or general manager in Chris Young, right? They've got the new manager. You're hoping that the player development continues to make strides in the ways that it did last year. You're hoping that they can continue to add to their talent evaluators so they can continue to add through the international free agency market, through the draft, through trades. Everything is on the upswing for the Rangers right now, even the major league team. So a lot of exciting things to come here for the Rangers. And Grant, we really appreciate you coming on and talking about these prospects with us for the upcoming 2023 season. But that'll do it for this episode of the Baseball Prospectus Podcast Network. Be sure to visit all of our other podcasts. We've done a lot of other top prospect series already. We've got all the other shows such as Five and Dive, The Infinite Inning, for all you kids out there. So a lot of really great shows on the Baseball Prospectus Podcast Network. So give it all a shout throughout this holiday season. But Grant, thank you again for joining us. And thank you guys for listening. We'll see you guys next time.